Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com, or you can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. All the information is there. The credit union is just that, a credit union. It belongs to you if you join it. It's not just a bank. So right now we're going to talk this hour about health disparities and racial health disparities, not just in Baltimore and Maryland, where they exist in a very serious way, but across this country. This is part of the Open Society Institute's continuing series talking about race that will take place this Thursday, September 15th at 7 p.m. at the Enoch Pratt Free Library. And that evening, they will be lucky to have the two people I have in the studio with me now. We have Dr. Michelle Gordine, who is a physician and author of the book Reclaiming Our Health, A Guide to African-American Wellness, and Dr. Thomas Leviste, who is director of the Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Disparity Solutions. And Drs. Gordine and Leviste, welcome. Good to have you both in the studio.
Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
The number here is 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to the Facebook page, which I'll open up, and you can write there as well. And we'll take your calls and questions any way they come at 410-319-8888. You know, every time you turn around, it seems that there's another study about health disparities in America. I mean, another one came out this year, and they are glaring and huge. And we get them over and over again. And we know how deep it is, and we'll talk about how deep in the course of the hour. But it always seems to me that we're always studying it, always bringing it out. But what do you do about it? Maybe that's starting at the end. But I'm starting there anyway to work my way backwards. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's a good question. And you're right. There are lots of studies that have been done over time, necessarily so, that clearly demonstrate that minorities have poor health status in this country and receive lower quality health care. I don't think that can be overstated, because there are still many who are not aware of the existence of disparities, or the extent to which disparities are pervasive throughout our society, including some healthcare professionals, I have to admit. And so it's important to be able to demonstrate peer-reviewed studies that show clearly that disparities exist. And you're absolutely right. What can we do about those? It's a complicated answer to a complicated question, and I'm sure we're going to get into those complexities.
We will get into that, yes. I mean, because we talked about some of the complexity before we went on the air. This is not a simplistic thing. Well, it's purely about racism, or it's purely about poverty, or it's purely about social class, individual behavior. It's just much more complex than just kind of blaming it on a sector of an idea or place.
Well, one way to think about it is that health care or health status is really the outcome of the underlying inequalities happening in society. So it's an indicator of how the overall society is doing in terms of dealing with inequalities as it relates to race, social class, and geography. So it's really across multiple dimensions. It has as much to do with behavior as it has to do with where you live and what you're exposed to, as it does to has to do with the quality of health care that you're receiving and being able to access. So it is complex, but there are things that can be done about it. There are things that are being done about it. And I think we'd be remiss if we left the impression that there's nothing that can be done and that this is immutable, because it isn't.
So I'm curious, as I was looking at some of these studies over the last week and looking at your book, and I one of the things I was wondering was, when you see glaring statistics, that let's say only 46% of African Americans are tested for colon cancer in America, I will get through a bunch more statistics before this hour is over. But has that also been divided around race and around class? I mean, in other words, is the disparity deeper among poor and working class people in America, less so among middle, upper middle class African Americans, Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, than it is among working class and poor people? Is it even there not so simple to divide?
So it really depends on what outcome you're looking at. You do find that disparities exist at all levels of economic status, all levels of educational status. So it is not the case, and I think we can't say this enough, it is not the case that race disparities is purely a function of social class. It is not. That is not true. However, we do find that the gap between black and white people differs based on economic status in some cases. So you might find smaller disparities at higher levels of income in some cases, but it really depends on which outcome, which health problem you're talking about. So this is part of what we were saying earlier about how complicated it is. The patterns are not always consistent that you find the same disparities at all levels of income and for all health conditions.
But I think the literature does demonstrate in general that African Americans in general have poorer health status than whites, and
right.
that disparity, although the extent of the gap may differ,
right.
there's still a gap.
Right. So I think that's important to say that the disparity is there regardless of income levels. How big that disparity is may vary for some outcomes based on what the outcome is in different income levels. But there is no doubt that we have a social class or economic disparity problem in this country, and we also have a race disparity problem in this country, and one is not causing the other. It's both.
So, and I'm curious as socially and kind of culturally how you see it causing both and why. We talked about earlier, and one of the things that you write about a lot and talk about a lot
mm-hmm.
Is that, and it's a very difficult thing to address and deal with, one out of two African-American women are obese.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a word that's also loaded.
Yes.
Loaded.
That's right. That's right. Because although clinicians may speak of obesity in purely medical terms,
right.
the way people interpret that term is very different. And to be quite frank, the way the term is used in society goes beyond just a clinical definition of obesity. Some people are making value judgments of other people when they call people obese. Let's be clear about that. One of the things that I look at in this book, and let me back up to talk about why I wrote this book, because mm-hmm. during my medical training, I began to learn about the disparities in health between, frankly, African Americans and whites. That's what I was most struck by, because those statistics were representing members of my family, members of my community, people who go to my church. I took it very personally. And I really did want to try to understand, well, why is that the case? Why is it that African Americans are affected by serious health conditions at far greater rates than any other group in this country? And more importantly, what is it that we can do about it? What I looked at specifically, though, were what are the cultural factors and what are some of the environmental factors that create this disparity, that cause this disparity to occur? Because one of the things that I noticed in being a physician, you know, we tend to give people advice. Eat 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. Get 30 minutes of exercise a day. And I was noticing that although we were imparting this wisdom to people, it wasn't necessarily being internalized. And I'll be really honest, even in my own life, I knew that I wasn't necessarily internalizing those things that I knew I needed to do in order to be healthy. So the question I wanted to answer was, what are the barriers, the complex barriers that keep us from being able to do what we want, what we know we need to do to be healthy, both in terms of culture and in terms of environment? And so that's what I look at in this book.
And kind of probing deeper, I mean, I think that and folks, I really want you to join us here at 410-319-8888 with your thoughts and questions and your ideas about the health disparities in America between white America and between communities of color. It's not just an African-American community. It's in, and we'll talk about, I won't just use the word Latino communities because that could mean a dozen things, but in communities of color. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. I mean, when you talk about, and I've had shows before we've talked about questions of image and body image and of the question of weight. And it invariably comes up, and the argument ensues, that black folks, Mexicans will say, no, this is our culture. This is who we are. We like a little meat on the bones. We like being big. It's a conception of beauty. Don't talk to me about that. You have no right to talk to me about that. So I mean, it's kind of all imbued with not just culture, but in the history of race in America, with racism, with sexism, with all of that is tied. That's why I'm saying that one stat is so complex and mm-hmm. so difficult, just even there to put your hands around, and talk about it and kind of get into a conversation about it because it's so loaded.
Absolutely, I mean, culture basically is a set of shared values and beliefs. And we can be members individually of lots of different cultures. I'm a member of the culture of African Americans. I'm a member of the culture of women. I'm a member of the culture of healthcare provider, physician. And those values and beliefs really determine our attitudes about certain things, like how we interpret the term obesity, and ultimately impact our behavior. If you tell me I'm obese, but I'm getting feedback from my mother, from my husband, from my friends, that I look great, I'm not going to be motivated to go and follow the rest of your advice, which is that you need to go and lose 10 or 15 or 20 pounds. You know, again, not to make it too simplistic, but I do think that one of the factors that we need to pay more attention to as healthcare providers in providing information about what we're talking about, which are the leading causes of death in this country, in this century, tend to be more related to things that we can control and things that we can and prevent to some extent. And so we have to begin to talk about how culture impacts that. And not only the culture and values and belief systems around obesity, but around a whole lot of other factors as well. And then we can't leave out the environmental factors. What do I mean by that? If I go and tell my patient, you need to eat right and you need to exercise 30 minutes a day, but you don't have access to healthy foods in your neighborhood, then that's very hollow advice. And so we need to consider people's behaviors in the context of the environments in which they live, and that's very important as well.
So in that regard, we conducted a study in a racially integrated community where there are no race differences in economic status. And one of the questions we wanted to know is, what's the nature of health disparities when people are living in the same environment, under the same challenging environment? In this case, this is a low-income community. What we found was that there was no race difference between black and white women in rates of overweight and obesity. The only place that I'm aware of where that's ever been documented, and it was a community here in Baltimore.
This is the one you did in Southwest Baltimore, right?
This is the study
you did there.
Yes, that study. We found no race differences between black and white women living in that environment because they're living in the same environment. They're living in a classic food desert. There's no supermarket in that community, no access, at least at the time of that study, no access to fresh fruit and vegetables. More recently, there's been actually quite a lot done in that community to try to improve the availability of fruit and vegetables. But at the time of the study, that wasn't there. So people didn't have the ability to eat. It was very difficult to eat a healthy diet, even if you had the inclination and even if you had the economic resources to afford to eat healthy. So the physical environment that we live in, the built environment, and by that I mean the environment that was created by humans for humans to live in, I believe plays more of a role in producing health disparities than anything else. It's really about place. It's where you live and what you're exposed to, what health risk you're exposed to, as well as what protective factors, what things that we are able to access that help us to live healthy lifestyles and have good health outcomes.
Let me open the phones. We have two phenomenal guests here as part of the Talking About Race series in OSI. You can meet them both Thursday night, September 15th, Enoch Pratt Library, Central Branch downtown, Dr. Michelle Gordine and Dr. Thomas Leviste, 410-319-8888, as we explore racial health disparities in our country and in our community here in Baltimore, in Maryland. And Al, is it Al Johnson or Al, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you for having these two great guests with us tonight. One of the things I notice is how conversations drive the way people are. And if we can take a look at that, then we can see that that's probably the current that runs the whole thing. And what I mean by that is take five young ladies who go to Bryn Mawr School.
I'm sorry. I'll say it again because you're breaking up. Your cell phone's breaking up a little bit.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Go ahead, yes.
Let's take maybe three or four girls who may go to private school and three or four girls who may go to Douglas High or Warbrook or Clifton. That conversation that's going on in those communities, in those schools, the chances are you're going to find hardly any black girls suffering from bulimia and anorexia. But go 5 miles up 83 and you find that conversation living and alive. So what's driving those young ladies is the conversations inside a community that is being driven by the industry about who they are. So no self-knowledge will start you moving in a direction of conversations driven by your industry or by people, even your mom and dad. You may have a mother who's very slim, but everything she wears is out of Cosmopolitan and Vogue. So how does she eat? She eats in a way that will give her the look that she wants. So what's the conversation in that household? The conversation is, you be great, because if you want certain things and certain men in your life or a certain look, this is the life you have to live, and this is the way you have to be. So I think the bottom line is that definitely it's about food and it's about that. But when you are educated in a conversation called, this is the way you should be because this is what you're going to get, the outcome is going to be what we see every day, either in a black community, a white community, a Jewish community, or a Chinese community.
Okay.
I just want to leave that with you.
Thank you so much. And that's part of what you talk about, Thomas Levice.
I think culture plays an important role. And I think what he's talking about is the transmission of culture. We often hear people say, diabetes runs in my family, or hypertension runs in my family, you know, and the implication there is that there's some gene that's producing this diabetes and is being passed down through birth, which is absolutely not scientifically likely. Most likely what's being passed down is the dietary habits and other behaviors that's producing hypertension and diabetes. So, yeah, it's passing down in your family because one generation is teaching the other generation how to live and how to protect their health, and they're producing same outcomes from one generation to the next.
Let's look at a couple of statistics that kind of really were shocking, and let's explore why they are and what they have to do with health care and what they have to do with how we approach health care and how health care approaches us, how it approaches people. I was really shocked. There's one study that was written by one of the things I was reading this morning that African-American women are 90% more likely to be diagnosed with advanced breast cancer than white women, even though rates of mammogram screening were similar between the two groups. What does that mean?
It's a little complex because what we're learning, what we initially used to be conventional wisdom was that the rates of screening for breast cancer were lower among African-American women. Well, we've closed that gap, and African-American women are being screened much more frequently than before. What we're also discovering, though, and this gets back to the genetic environmental issue, is that there is a type of breast cancer that is thought to be genetically linked, that is extremely aggressive, that shows up in younger African-American women in their 20s. That's part of it. The other part of it, I think, still has to do with factors that influence how we seek care. In other words, our screening rates are up, and that's a good thing. What we do in terms of seeking appropriate and or aggressive care after diagnosis is still an issue that I think needs to be fleshed out in terms of factors related to fear. You know, cancer is still a stigmatized disease in the African-American community. My father died of cancer about 13 years ago. He always called it the big C. He never even said the word cancer. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stigma and fear around that that caused people to delay treatment. And there were some treatment decisions that he made that were perhaps less aggressive than what was recommended. I think that's something that needs to be looked into more. I think that it's a very complicated issue. I don't think we completely understand how to explain the fact that African-American women are diagnosed with more advanced forms of breast cancer. But what we are able to do is to go out into the communities and encourage African-American women to be screened, to have other African-American women go and who speak the language, who understand the culture, to get over some of the other barriers like fear, like lack of information and lack of knowledge to increase those breast cancer screening rates. Can I say one more thing, too, because I had to go back and edit my book, because right before my book was due to go to the publisher, the new breast cancer screening guidelines came out that changed the frequency of screening among women. And it concerned me primarily because we were making so much progress in terms of getting African-American women to be proactive and get screened. As you know, the recommendations changed. Used to be that you were supposed to get screened once a year starting at age 40. It was changed so that now there's no screening recommended at all at age 40. The screening starts at age 50, and it's every other year. To me, it's a worry because we may be erasing some of the ground that we've gained in terms of encouraging African-American women to get screened proactively. And I think that there are some factors that, that certainly need to come into play and some discussions that African-American women need to have with their doctors in terms of looking at getting screened earlier than the recommended age of 50. I just wanted to get that out there because I think that African-American women need to talk to their doctors about that.
We did a show about that particular issue when that whole idea came, when the whole proposal came out to have mammograms and screenings later than earlier. And there are a lot of people in that, one person in that program, a physician, was saying that this is driven by money, not by science. This is driven by not wanting to pay for something that needs to be dealt with because we don't know the roots of breast cancer. You may have a genetic preponderance for breast cancer, but that could be unleashed by environmental factors we have yet to even study about why there's so much breast cancer in America, why there's no breast cancer, very little breast cancer in Japanese women until they become Japanese-American women and live in this country, then the rates are the same. So there's some argument that when you talk about health disparities in terms of race and in terms of class, that a lot of it does come back to what insurance companies and others are willing to pay for and what they're not.
Well, I hesitate to say that that decision to change the breast cancer screening guidelines was entirely based on money, because I've served on one of those panels, one on colorectal cancer, and I know how those reviews go, and they are very much driven by science and not allowed politics and economics are not allowed to be a part of it. The issue is whether or not it's necessary to screen every woman every year for cancer, for breast cancer, beginning at age 40. And I think that we could probably all agree that if we were able to observe each individual woman and make decisions that are tailored to that particular woman's needs, we would agree that there are some women who should be screened beginning at age 40, and there are other women who don't need to be screened as frequently as once per year. The question is, how do you create a policy that's going to capture most of the people rather than a policy that's going to be designed to reach the, you know, sort of the person who is at greatest risk? And those are the sorts of trade-offs that we make when we're creating policy for populations, not for individuals.
Now, let me open the phones again. I'm going to come back with, because when the thing you just raised and something I read about, you that wrote about, is it Bidil?
Bidil.
Thank you very much. Bidil, and what you were saying about genetic preponderance for certain young women, African-American women. But I'll come back to that. Let's go to the phones and get this question here first. 410-319-8888 is the number here as we look at health disparities in America, racial health disparities in America. Dr. Michelle Gordien, Dr. Thomas LaVista with us here in the studio. And Chuck, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
It's kind of interesting that if I can listen to the racial disparities of the healthcare industry. I think a lot you folks might be taking out the whole genetic fact behind it, that certain, if you're going to look at race, it's a per-person account. And if you're going to do the study, you're going to say, well, this person's more deficient there, this person's more deficient there, or somewhere else. Everybody has a choice to exercise and to eat properly. Genetically, your body's going to do whatever it wants to do, and nobody should be blocked or barred from having screenings or anything of that nature, no matter what color you are. And that's one thing in this country that people are doing a lot to move forward from. Everyone has a choice. And I'm kind of curious to ask if in your studies that you guys have done, did everybody have – people made their own choices to go do things and, you know, to get up and get off the couch and get outside. You can always leave your neighborhood. Grocery stores deliver. The city has a massive bus system to where you can get from one side of the town to the other to get to a grocery store. So I'm kind of curious as to how all that plays into this.
So unfortunately, everyone doesn't have a choice. And everyone has a set of choices, but not everyone has the same set of choices or as wide a spectrum of options. We live in a country where upwards of 50 million Americans don't have health insurance, access to health insurance, which means that their choices are dramatically constrained compared to people that do. We also have dramatic differences geographically in one community versus another, one city versus another city, suburbs versus other suburbs, especially in rural areas, and the availability of healthcare services. Even if you do have health insurance, you may not be able to access care because those services simply are not available where you live. So it goes far beyond the individual's ability to exercise choice, but it's also about policy and who is determining where those resources are going to be located and therefore who's able to access those resources. And unfortunately, that tracks with race. But having said that, I think it's also important, a point that the caller makes when he's talking about the genetic aspect of it. And I think it gives us an opportunity to get a little bit more deeply into this. What the idea of genetics, I think, is often confused in popular discussions, because we create this idea by saying that, you know, black women have this gene that is producing breast cancer, that there are black genes and white genes and Hispanic genes and so on, and the black gene produces breast cancer and also makes your skin black and also makes your hair texture a certain hair texture and also produces obesity. There's a gene that does all of that, right? Unlikely. So in reality, the gene that we're talking about, this, I assume you're talking about the BRCA gene. That gene exists in all populations that we have in the United States. It's not constrained to the African Americans, and it's not even more predominant among African Americans. What we know less about, and what is probably much more likely the case here, rather than this being about genetics, is being about the interaction of that gene and other environmental exposures. Some of these exposures we may not yet even know what they are. So people are living in different environments. They're experiencing the world differently, and therefore they're exposed to health risks in part based on their own social characteristics, such as their race or their economic status. And therefore, those exposures have an opportunity to interact with biological mechanisms. And if it's the case that black women are getting a more aggressive form of breast cancer, it's probably because black women are more likely to be exposed to those environmental factors that activate that gene and produce the breast cancer. It's less likely the case that black women have the gene that produces breast cancer.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead, please.
No, and I think that's Michelle. An important distinction for Tom to make, because when we're talking about genetics and throwing around that term, people interpret that very differently. The other important point I think we need to make is that race is not genetic. Race is not genetically determined. Some people tend to believe that, you know, African Americans have certain commonalities in terms of genetics. That is not true. Race is a social construct.
Right.
And I think that we need to make that point very, very clear, because many assumptions that sort of derive from that inappropriate thought that race is genetic can be dispelled by understanding that fact.
Well, if I could just to piggyback on that. So we've got President Obama, who's got two Kenyan grandparents and two white American grandparents. We call him African American. We've got Colin Powell, who has one Scottish grandparent, one Irish grandparent, and two Jamaican grandparents. We call him African American. We've got Tiger Woods, who has one Chinese grandparent, one Thai grandparent, one white American grandparent, and one African American and Native American grandparent, and we call him African American.
That's right.
So who did they inherit which gene from? And how could you know that by looking at their skin? So the idea that race is genetics is just absolutely ludicrous. And anyone who has fourth grade knowledge of American history knows that if there ever were pure races, which I'm not even ready to concede that, but even if they ever did exist, that anyone whose family's been in this country more than three or four generations have some combination of European, African, and Native American ancestry.
Absolutely. Right?
And that's everybody, by the way.
That's everybody.
That's everybody.
So, that's right. That's
everybody
right.
In this hemisphere, frankly.
Right.
Has gotten
that's right. Those who we call white Americans as well.
That's yeah. right. That's right. And Mark, let me just make one other point to the caller's point, talking about choice and personal responsibility, because we often hear that argument being
right.
purported as well. The playing field is not level. As Tom was describing, we don't all have equal access to the resources that we need to be healthy. Health insurance, access to healthy foods, safe neighborhoods, physical activity, the list goes on and on and on. And that's another very important point that needs to be brought out in this conversation.
We're going to take a break, and we come back. We'll continue this conversation. Stan, you're the next caller up. We'll get you a phone call as well as we talk about health disparities, racial health disparities in America. Dr. Michelle Gordien, Dr. Thomas Leviest. And let me just say that unless you have taken a bus from one end of town to the other and back again to buy groceries, you have no idea what that entails. When you're older, when you have no money, when you're carrying heavy bags, but we'll get to all that when we come back, so please stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I'm going to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Women's Health for every stage of a woman's life, offering comprehensive care and comprehensive obstetric and gynecological services from routine exams to specialized pelvic surgery. More information is available at 1-800-492-5538 or www.umm.edu/womencenter. Again, 800-492-5538 for the Women's Center at Maryland. Their banner is at steinershow.org. You can click on University of Maryland Medical Systems banner, and all the information is there as well. And speaking of health, that's what we're talking about today. We're talking about racial health disparities in our country today. To be part of a conversation, my two guests today will be having at the Central Branch of the Enoch Pratt Free Library this Thursday at 7 p.m., September 15th, at the continuing series, the Open Society Institute Baltimore series of Talking About Race. Dr. Michelle Gordine is a physician and the author of the book, Reclaiming Our Health, A Guide to African-American Wellness. And Dr. Thomas Leviste is director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Disparity Solutions. And the number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Now, when we were talking about this, before we go to Stan, our next caller up, about the kind of racial differences we make are fairly bogus to look at in our society and the world. One of the things that the question you raised about Barack Obama, Thomas Leviste, was something that I also heard you had said in reference to the drug Bidil. Yeah. So when you see drugs come out that are created for the African American community, what does that mean?
Yeah. and the drug failed, right?
It's
a long story, which obviously we can't get into on this show. But, you know, Bidil was a drug for treatment of congestive heart failure, which is a debilitating disease that affects about 500,000 new cases per year. Very short life expectancy once you're diagnosed. And it's a drug that came out in the 1970s, actually. It was tested on all populations, and it's been shown to be pretty effective overall. And through a variety of circumstances led the owners of that patent to do a clinical trial on only African Americans to demonstrate that it was effective, and FDA in 2005 approved the drug for use only in African Americans.
Only
in African Americans, so that non African Americans, who we all also know would benefit from the drug, are not supposed to be given the drug. And so it's a long story. I don't know that we won't want to get sidetracked on that long story on this show, but it's really just amazing. So what happens, the drug hits the market in 2005, and the company Nitromed went out of business last year because no one would add it to their panels. No one would add it to their no one would prescribe the drug because they were able to use generic versions of the drugs that made up that one pill and have the same benefit. So it is a potentially helpful drug that could be used and could be out there if it was available to everyone, but pretty much it's not available anymore because of this the conflation of politics and science. And when science and politics come together, politics usually wins.
Politics, as Bob Marley would say.
Yeah.
410-319-8888. And Stan, you're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Stan. How are you?
I'm well. Welcome.
Good, thank you. I got riled up about with the caller who talked about choices.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a psychotherapist, and I treat my clients holistically. And you cannot look at one person's situation and, for example, a privileged person and say, oh, everybody has the same choice, because that is not true. There are different stressors and different situations that cause people to do what they do. Mm-hmm. For example, if you have someone who's in an impoverished neighborhood with variable dynamics in the family, you may have drug problems or whatever. It's very difficult for them to think about exercise and diet and that type of thing. So you can't really, say that everybody has the same choices. That's ridiculous.
I think that's absolutely right. Everybody doesn't have the same choices. The playing field is not level. We make decisions based on the circumstances within which we live and based on the resources that we have. The caller makes a great point about certain stressors that occur, not exclusive to one race or another, but occur in certain types of environments that cause us to adopt coping mechanisms that may not be the healthiest. You know, when you're stressed out, at least when I am, I want to eat. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, I want the least healthy thing available to eat. And right. Furthermore, I don't feel like going to the gym. You know, so those types of factors really do need to be considered. I think the caller makes an excellent point.
But that's part of why what you two do is so important, what you're talking about right now, Michelle, is that, I mean, you have to keep it real.
Absolutely.
If we're going to get to anybody.
Absolutely. You do have to keep it real. I mean, we need the science. We absolutely need the science. But we know so much about this whole disparities issue. We don't know everything. And it's time to translate that information so that it's understandable and practical for the community to be able to adopt and apply to their own lives. And that's one of the main reasons I wrote my book, in order to translate what we do know. There's more we need to know, but there's enough that we do know that we need to be able to translate in order for people to be able to apply to their own lives and improve their own health.
Let's kind of rest with one. One statistic came out that really blew my mind was the disparity in infant mortality rates. That was absolutely shocking. I mean, twice as many African American, the rate is twice as high in African Americans than it is in white Americans. Twice as high, 6.86 to 13.63 per 1,000 live births. That's phenomenal. That's insane.
And that's been a recalcitrant statistic. I mean, it has really, for all intents and purposes, not budged for decades. And the other interesting thing about this is when you look at more educated African-American women and compare their infant mortality rate to that of white women, you find that more highly educated, higher income African-American women have a higher infant mortality rate than a much lower educated, lower income white woman. We haven't quite teased out all the reasons behind that. There have been some thoughts that stress and dealing with stress may have something to do with that. But again, that's been a really recalcitrant statistic that has not budged for a long, long time.
Yeah. There's also a great deal of variation across the country in that statistic. So you'll have some communities where you'll have very small race differences or even no race differences. And there's a couple of cities, and I'll tell you where they are, where there are no race differences. Or the African-American rate is actually lower than the white rate. But then on the other hand, we have some cities where the black rate is 3 in one city where at least the last time I looked was 5 times higher than the white rate. So there's that double rate you talk about is the national norm,
the national average. Right.
But when you look across the country, you see dramatic variation.
Well, what are those cities and what do you make of that?
The cities where you have either no disparities or the black rate's even lower than the white rate, they're used two categories. Either they're cities that have been in economic decline to the extent that all of the middle-class whites have left. For example, East St. Louis was one of those cities. Gary, Indiana was another where you had that. So there the white rate was much higher than you would normally find. Or there are cities that are predominantly military bases. We find that in the active-duty military, the disparities are much smaller than in the general population. Yet in the VA, we find the same disparities that we find in the general population.
Any notions about why this is?
Yeah, because in the military, when you're active duty, it's not about black culture or white culture. It's about green culture, right? So you are ordered to have your physical. You will eat here. You will live here. And they're living in an integrated environment, and they're living very similar lifestyles and having very—
But they're not black barracks and white barracks. It's not a black neighborhood for soldiers and white neighborhood for soldiers or a Mexican neighborhood for soldiers.
Right, so you don't have those disparities.
So in that community, you know, your playing field is much more level than it would be in communities outside. That's really interesting, Tom.
So if you could extrapolate that idea out to all the other disparities we could talk about, which we hope to get into before the end of the hour, what does it say to you about what needs to be done? I mean, how do you two address that when you address these issues to the larger public? I mean, because if you know the kind of things you're talking about, there are ways to ameliorate this, whether it's in a personal way or a society. So what do you all think? What do you put out there?
Well, what I'd say is that it's not as much about race as it is about place. right? It's where you're living and what you're exposed to. But unfortunately, race determines place. So your race determines where you're going to be living, and that in turn determines what your exposures are. So it's much more about that than about some characteristic of the individual. So what we need to do is improve the living conditions in which people live and equalize them, and you'll find disparities will follow suit.
That's what hit me before I turn over to Michelle, that when you describe the places where that is different, that's what hit me. A, you're talking about, well, the disparity doesn't exist because everybody is so poor, most of them are not white, and so that's why there's no disparity.
Right.
But where it really breaks down is when there is, as the military has always been, even though it doesn't always want to be, at the forefront of kind of racial changes in America,
yeah.
It has been for a long time, that it's a place where you find that equality. So the question of the idea of equality, true equality, has a lot to do with all the underlying conditions that you wrestle with, that both of you wrestle with, when it comes to racial health care disparities.
That's exactly right. And Tom is right. Place is extremely important. One of the very fascinating things that you'll find is that African Americans who have relatively middle class or even higher income across the board generally are more likely than white Americans with that same income to live in lower income communities. And so you find that you've got a cohort of people, African Americans, who aren't necessarily poor, but they're living in a place that is poor of the resources needed to be healthy, and so they suffer the same poor health outcomes. And so place is extremely important. Developing policies that acknowledge the need for to get rid of food deserts, improving reducing criminal activity in neighborhoods so that people have safe and affordable opportunities for physical activity are important. So there are things that can be done on the place side. There are also things that can be done on the personal side, because I found, as I've gone across the country talking about my book, that people want to feel like they have the power, the ability to do something about their health. So learning about the high blood pressure and the obesity that's in our community and the diabetes and the heart disease and the stroke and what that means and what you can begin to do even at a small level, taking small steps to be able to move toward a healthier existence, I think is also important. To the extent that you're able to access those resources in your community, in your environment, I think it's important to empower people to be able to do that, to know what they need to do in order to be healthier mm-hmm. and to live healthier. And then there are things that can be done on the healthcare provider side as well. First of all, acknowledging the fact that disparities exist. Second of all, making sure that decisions that are made regardless of patient are evidence-based and not necessarily based on some other factors that may have to do with an individual's perception of a patient based on their race or their culture or their economic status. I think those things are important as well to improve the quality of health care that people receive. And focusing on prevention. Honestly, our health care system is a sick care system. We treat. Fortunately, there are some provisions in healthcare reform that sort of tip that balance so that we have a more balanced system that's not only dealing with treatment, which is extremely important, but also preventive health as well and wellness. And I think focusing on that is also important.
I think there's also a role for policy. That when I moved to Baltimore back in 1990, there were very few supermarkets anywhere in the city, in any neighborhood. And the decision to not open supermarkets in Baltimore City, those are policy decisions. Policy decisions made, in this case, in the corporate boardroom more so than in government policy. The decisions of where to locate or how to incentivize physicians to locate in certain communities,
mm-hmm.
these are policy decisions. So all of these sorts of policy decisions impact communities, where you put bus lines and expose people to the fumes from buses. Policy decisions. I mean, so we also have to look at policy. We have to create an environment where people can exercise choice in a way that they're able to make those choices that are going to be most helpful for them.
There's an email from Gwen. I wonder if it's interesting. Gwen has written in, one of the things that people who believe themselves to be quote-unquote victims of these types of health disparities have to remember is that by definition, the system that creates the disparity cannot be expected to find solutions to it. We have to take responsibility for educating ourselves, or at the very least asking the questions and seeking the answers to the questions that will enable us to make better decisions. For example, white sugar is not food. It's a chemical that wreaks havoc on the adrenal system, yet we continue to overindulge in the consumption of cookies, cakes, candy, sodas. The list goes on and on. We feed this stuff to our children, allow it in our school systems to feed this stuff to our children. In the absence of the availability of whole foods, we can begin by decreasing our dependence, purchase of those foods that are clearly detrimental to our health. We can then begin to see the need to replace the non-foods that we have been eating. We begin to ask, what are viable replacements? And then we begin to demand from our food service providers a better quality of food. As long as we keep paying for chemical additives being passed off as food, the merchants will continue to realize their profit margins. There's an old adage that says, prevention is worth a pound of cure. And the decisions that victims of health disparities make to take preventative measures will go a long way to improving our communal health.
Interesting email, loaded with any number of topics that we could talk about. Let me talk about food for a second. I think the emailer does bring up an important point about the types of food that we eat. Michael Pollan wrote a book, In Defense of Food, where he said he gave the three rules for eating. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Very good advice. Basically, what he's talking about is eating things that pretty much look the same way that they do when they come out of the ground.
Right.
That's very important for people to do. And this goes back to education. You know, if you live in a neighborhood, and there are studies that reveal that in low-income neighborhoods across this country, you're twice as many fast food restaurants as supermarkets or grocery stores in those neighborhoods. And I'm not picking on fast food, but we all know that there are certain ingredients in fast food that are less healthy. The white sugar that she's talking about, they tend to be higher in fat, higher in processed carbohydrates, all of which are less healthy. Tom's point is extremely important. Health policy is a very, very important venue that we have to explore, because what we're trying to do is to create an environment where the healthy choice is the easy and affordable choice. You can't fault someone who has a low income from going to a place that's convenient, being able to buy cheap food that's able to nourish, to feed their children. What we need to do is to create an environment where the healthier choice is as costs as little as the unhealthy choice does. And we also need to become more educated about the types of foods that are healthy for us to choose. And we can go on and on beyond that, but I just chose the food as one example. She brings up a lot of points in her email that I don't think we have time to get into.
Tom?
Well, I mean, I agree. So that's all I would say in response to that. I think the emailer is correct. I mean, people do have agency, and an educated and empowered patient is going to be the most effective patient and is going to get the best health care. So yeah, I think we need to be teaching people how to be an effective patient.
What about the other side of it then? What about the side that you two live in, the side of the healthcare provider, the physician? When you see the numbers of people who do not have access to primary care, do not take advantage of what they do have because it's not close by, those statistics are pretty revealing as well. I mean, half of all, whatever we mean by Latinos, are without a regular doctor to see. And that means probably more, because we're talking probably about Mexicans and immigrants more than we are talking about Cubans, maybe to a lesser degree Puerto Ricans. But I mean, so, because we always want to make Latinos just one mass. They're not a mass.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So,
well, I think no groups are a mass.
No
right?
groups. I agree. groups are a mass, right?
So, so healthcare access is a problem. Healthcare quality. So even if you get access to care, making sure that there aren't racial differences in the quality of care that you receive. There's a lot of documentation that demonstrate that even once you do get into care, that there are disparities in the quality of care that you receive. There are also disparities in who gets referred for specialty care. So once you get beyond primary care, do you get to see the specialist? You know, we did a study a few years back here in Baltimore where we looked at a few hospitals. I won't name them, but a few hospitals, and it wasn't honor of my employer, I'll say that Johns Hopkins was not one of the hospitals in that study, but I don't know that disparities wouldn't have been found there as well. Probably would have, because it's been found everywhere else. But in that study, we looked at access to specialty cardiac care. In other words, who got to see a cardiologist?
Right.
And there were disparities. Even among people that were insured, did show up in the hospital to get care and did get that care, did get seen by a physician, who got to see a cardiologist? Race was predictive. even when we take insurance out of the equation. And obviously the patient's interest in getting seen, the patient was interested because they did come to the hospital to get care. So we have disparities throughout the entire chain of events that occur that produces health outcomes, from prevention to curative care to specialty care and ultimately life expectancy.
And I think this is another opportunity, not to put the onus back on the patient, but to the extent that we can create the empowered patient that Tom is talking about, a patient that goes in to see the doctor with a list of questions that they want to ask, that goes in and sits with the doctor until they understand exactly what their condition is, what their treatment options are. Well, doctor, do I have to go down this route, or is there another form of treatment that might be better for me given my circumstances? Those types of things are really important, too. And I talk about in my book the fact that there are many people who are sort of reluctant, tend to be passive. Doctor knows best. Doctors
right.
know a lot.
Right.
But you know a lot, too. And quite frankly, unless you're extremely ill, you're only going to see the doctor once, maybe twice a year. The other 363 days of the year, you're responsible for your health. And so there are things that you need to be able to do that. If you're reluctant, I tell folks, take somebody with you who's the loudmouth, the talkative one. Let them be the bad guy. Play good cop, bad cop. Let them be the bad cop and ask the questions and demand answers and demand accountability, because that absolutely is something that has been keeping the quality of health care received and the health outcomes from being what they could be.
Let's try to squeeze one more caller. Can we, a very quick question. Clarence, we only have a couple minutes left, so go ahead.
This is just something that I witnessed doing a job. It was 8 o'clock in the morning in a local supermarket, very small supermarket, and all I saw was a parade of people, not a small number of people, coming in at 8 o'clock in the morning buying cold-cut sandwiches, pig feet, pig ears, pig tails, and oxtails. And this, you know, I was amazed at myself that these items that they were buying were all of the things that I would be considered unhealthy for as a diet. And I was just wondering, is this a matter of, you know, that's a matter of choice to me as opposed to disparity. These people are making a conscious choice to make these
things. All right, well, we have literally like a minute left, so if you want to just
go
a
ahead.
Very quick
I'm
response.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Class, let me just go turn to our guests.
Thank you for taking the call.
Thank you so much.
I think it's a matter of two things. One, knowledge. You can't assume that the people who are purchasing these foods understand that they may be less healthy than the other options. And two, choice. I mean, the question I would have is, you know, what's the availability of other types of foods in that establishment where he was? But, you know, again, it gets back to knowledge, to education. If you don't know that a cold-cut sandwich is bad for you, if you grew up in an environment where people ate cold-cut sandwiches for breakfast and you don't know any better, then there's a knowledge and an education aspect that needs to be considered.
And it's cultural in many ways. I mean, it's whether, you know, certain cultures, I mean, you know, people talk about in the black culture, the food that came out of slavery. But I look at my grandmother who was Jewish. And the stuff she cooked, all that fat floating around and everything else that people ate, I mean, it came out of her own. You know, get the cheapest thing we can.
That's
and
right.
Load with fat, and we're going to eat it.
That's right. I grew up in the South. Same thing.
Right?
Yeah.
I defy you to find a meal in Hungary that's not deep fried.
There you go.
Good luck.
Folks, I encourage you all to go to the Enoch Pratt Free Library this Thursday night. I want to thank Dr. Michelle Gordine, physician and author of the book Reclaiming Our Health, A Guide to African-American Wellness, Dr. Thomas Levise, who is director of the Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Disparities Solutions. They will both be part of a conversation. They'll be the conversation this Thursday night, 7 p.m., the Enoch Pratt Central Branch Free Library on the 15th. That's at 7 p.m., part of the Open Society Institute series Talking About Race. And I want to thank both of you for being with us. It's been a pleasure to have you in the studio.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
See you all Thursday night. Stay tuned. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ari Berman about a very frightening trend, in especially Republican-led states, to change voting rights and disenfranchise voters that by the millions. And then we talk with Dr. Nawal El-Sawadi, one of the great human rights leaders from Egypt. She'll be at Morgan State University's campus Thursday and talk with us this afternoon. So stay with us. We'll be right back.